Hello, everyone, and good evening. Welcome to another episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. This episode was produced by me, Alan Ibrahim, and it was recorded back in late April. So please be aware of that if we say anything in the episode that may or may not be timely or appropriate anymore. Make sure to also stay tuned after the episode for some extra special announcements about what we got going on in the present day on Chats. Please enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, season 10! Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. My name is Alan, and content pays the king. Distribution pays his mortgage. And podcasting helps the king pass the time. Here he is. It's the king himself, Magellan.
Bow down to me. I'm the king.
Hey. Feed me content, Seymour.
I'm here to do my podcast about serfdom.
I love it. Surf. It's called Surfin' USA, but it's S-E-R-F-I-N.
What I've found in interviewing everyone is that serfdom is great.
And you should all bow down to this ass.
Yes.
Well, Magellan, welcome to the podcast. It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
That
was the quality level of a Studio 60 sketch, that bit that I just did.
Wow. So. Yeah. It's a funny voice and a single sentence gag. Exactly.
Yep. And it's just like ruthlessly intellectual to the point of being stupid.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, God. You're so right. I'm excited to talk about sketches this week because we have more than just Studio 60 episode sketches to talk about. But it's not just you and me, Magellan. No.
Uh-oh.
I'm also joined by the person who only needs three words added to her vocabulary. Love the Mets. It's six, everyone. Hello, welcome to the podcast.
I could get by with the Mets. The Mets, listen, I'm not like a Mets fan, but like, you know, you're stuck in town with the Yankees. You don't have much choice. You're stuck between a rock and a shit place. You pick the rock, right? You head to Los Angeles, though. You head here.
Yeah.
To the West Coast, to the best coast, to the test coast, where all the new ideas are tested out, because that's California.
West Coast-style rap I've heard of so much?
And because you wonder where your politics come from. You wonder where your new policies come from. And they come from California. You're fucking welcome. And you come here, and you're like, oh, it's great over here. What do we got? Oh, what's this? Oh, is the Los Angeles Angel? These guys seem okay.
Oh, but sure.
I'm supposed to pick between them and this other who? It looks like it says like the duh. I can't quite read it because someone crossed it out and wrote pieces of fucking garbage.
Oh gosh,
wow. God sakes, are you crazy about the Dodgers or just crazy?
Yeah, nice work. We got a twofer.
I do my best.
Shout outs to Magellan's mom. I will swear less this episode.
Wow.
That was your one. And we can keep our PG-13 rating.
Right, the network, the standards and practices aren't going to get mad at us this time.
I won't even mention anybody's name in vain.
I'm excited to talk about these episodes, but before we do, I want to mention something that I kind of hinted at up top. In the interim of the last episode and this one, I've watched and read about a little bit of SNL history here and there, just to kind of get more of a feel for like where SNL was at the time of the show, and sort of like what the cultural like opinion is of the series and what people's favorite sketches are. And I've watched a lot of SNL sketches in the past week. And what my research has returned to me is that maybe SNL isn't good, y'all. Maybe it's not great.
What?
Yeah, hold on. Get this for a sec. Take a second.
Okay.
Are you sitting? I hope you're sitting.
Well, hang on. Let me... All right.
There is comedy. There are legitimately moments in SNL that I still laugh at to this day. I mean, I still think David S. Pumpkins is brilliant, right? I understand why More Cowbell is funny. But I don't laugh at these things anymore. And you think like, oh, maybe it's the times. Maybe it's just like distance from the bit or not getting it or not getting the actor's sort of like vibe. But I even watched like recent stuff. And what like, you know, I would say the first SNL at home episode is not a perfect barometer for what modern SNL looks like. But modern SNL does also feature Michael Che like dunking on liberals for wanting Bernie to win presidency. Like it just... we talk about like all everybody on Studio 60 punches down, right? And like they do that on SNL. They like still do that. It's kind of frustrating how little it's evolved past the like pantomime that the show portrays it as.
Have you considered though that maybe you just don't get it?
I'm certain I always want to maintain an open mindset.
Like maybe it's too smart for you.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's actually very simple.
Yeah, I think your brain is bad. I think you like Jesus and your brain is bad.
Well, Matt Albee's here on the podcast. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Literally this afternoon, by the way, I saw an ad that's making the rounds right now because it's kind of big. But it's for HBO Max, which I think is like HBO's new subscription service that's, I think, separate from, you know, all their other ones. And it says, it's three characters. It's Tony Soprano, and it says, where Bada? And then it's Chandler Bing, and it says, meets Bing. And it's Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, and it says, meets Bang. So, where Bada meets Bing meets Bang. Just the image of Tony Soprano next to... To Chandler that's next cursed. To Sheldon.
That's cursed.
It's really great. It's really fantastic. That's the world that we live in.
That's cursed.
So when you think about comedy, you think about sketch stuff, and you're like, oh, it doesn't reflect the real world. Like, the real world is very, very, very weird and silly and cartoonish.
And also, Chandler is still an icon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we love Chandler here. We're Chandler fans.
I'm the only person on this podcast who hasn't watched a lot of Friends. That's the other thing.
Well, define a lot.
Well, I always forget that his name is Matthew Perry. That's how little Friends I watched.
He's but I just have a memory.
What do you say?
Yeah, this isn't...
In this show, I think of him as Matt Albee. He's Aaron Sorkin's viewer substitute.
See, this is the thing where, like, my friend, I think this is, you know, we all have our different situations. Mm-hmm. And part of your situation is that your memory doesn't always record as well as it should.
Yeah.
I don't always
hit the big red button on,
right,
the, on that.
Right, right. So I wonder if it's to do with that or, you know, what.
It could be so many things, honestly. I'm also learning right now in looking up what his name was on Friends that Elliot Gould was on Friends as like his dad. Is that true?
Elliot Gould? As Ross and Monica's dad, yeah.
Oh, wait, Bing, sorry. Wait, no.
Oh, wait, no. Oh, am I getting it wrong? I'm getting it wrong.
Jack Geller. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Jack Geller.
Yeah, I'm the one who's watched Friends.
I'm the one who watched.
95% of sketch is bad. That's the thing of it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Like, you know, SNL is bad. It's just the truth. There are great sketches, but it is bad. I think
so. No one told you jokes were gonna be this way.
That's what that sounded like.
Yeah. Way off the off pace.
It's okay. It's okay. Alan will fix it with audio magic.
I'll make it perfect. Exactly. Wow. Thanks.
Hey, listen, I had to sync up someone three different times in the last podcast I edited to a random YouTube clip of someone saying the same thing. You can handle a little clapping.
No.
Oh,
way.
I can't wait to listen to that episode.
No,
I know what you're talking about.
No way.
Emma's back. Is Emma back?
Emma is back, but also Nick made repeated references to the intros to Food Wishes videos starring Chef John, and I had some work to do. So,
well, I'm excited to listen to that, and people should go check that out. That's an episode of Bottle Crow Reborn, the best Dota podcast here on this side of the Mason-Dixon line.
Our secret is we don't really talk about Dota.
Exactly. Yeah. So this week on Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats, we watched two episodes of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. It's the two-parter, collectively known as Nevada Day. The first part was written by Aaron Sorkin, with story by Mark McKinney, and it was directed by, get this, Leslie Linka Glatter, as well as Timothy Busfield, and it aired November 6th of 2006.
Wait, where do we know? Who's Leslie Linka Glatter? When do I know?
Oh, but she's like done a lot of writing. She's done a lot of Sorkin stuff. I think she's actually done a little couple like newsroom episodes.
Is that,
and
maybe I know her name from the newsroom.
Well, I believe she also worked on a lot of Buffy. If I'm not mistaken, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Maybe you've heard of
never
it.
Never heard of it.
No, not familiar.
No,
well,
I spent the 90s watching Friends. So,
she also did a bunch of Mad Men. No, she's done like a ton of stuff.
Oh, cool.
The West Wing, Grey's Anatomy, The OC. What else is in here? NYPD Blue, Twin. She did a little bit of Twin Peaks. She's a very prolific TV person, TV director.
So, if you haven't seen Buffy, There's the guy from Rat Race, and he plays like a werewolf boy, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And that's basically the
rat,
you know, it's,
race.
It's, I was trying for the weirdest two dots to connect I could think of.
Oh, okay. I have seen Buffy. Thank you for that.
Of course.
Who the hell is in Rat Race? Breckin Meyer?
Everyone's in Rat Race. All of us are in the Rat Race, right?
Right?
You guys ever see that clip of Cuba Gooding Jr. being like, somebody suck that baby's dick?
Unfortunately, yes, I did.
It's very good.
That's the 5% of sketch that is good.
Seth Green was who I was talking about.
He was in Buffy. That's true.
He was in Buffy. I like a Seth Green.
I want one of those, please.
I enjoy a Seth Green.
Thank you, Chef.
Alan, ask me what happened. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, what happened? What happened in Nevada Day Part 1?
Okay, in this episode, Harriet is cited in an interview as being anti-homosexual, though she claims to have been impartial in her comments. This causes a dispute in which Tom injures a man protesting against Harriet. Through a unique series of events, Tom is later arrested. Following this, a variety of cast and staff from NBS travel to Pahrumph, a small town in Nevada, to get Tom out of jail in time for his show that night. The presiding judge is not a fan of Studio 60.
Oh. Now, I love the tenor of that summary, that it's just so like, and this happens. In addition, this happens. Finally, this is the thing.
This episode really represents a chief pet peeve that I have with Aaron Sorkin's writing. His like plot writing.
Just one?
Which is that he'll come up with these stories that have odd twists and turns, but then constantly throughout, his characters will be like, boy, this is weird, huh? This is crazy. Like, Danny Tripp keeps calling, oh my God, her name, the lady.
Wow.
Jordan?
Jordan McDear. Jordan? He keeps calling Jordan McDear, and he's like, yeah, Jordan, we're in Pahrumph, Nevada. And the judge isn't even here. It's crazy. And it's like, yeah, it's the story of the episode. And then like Matt busts into Harriet's dressing room and he's like, yeah, the whole crew is over in some town in Nevada. It's like a freaking movie. I don't even remember who he refers to. Oh, it's the cast of a Fellini film is on the plane right now. And then he names all the characters in the show. And it's like, Matt, I know I'm watching
the episode.
It's like a mix of like previously on in the middle of the episode, a laugh track and a Greek chorus.
Right. And it happens at the end, too, where Matt Albee busts into the room with the actors, and he's like, so the story went like this. Harriet went on an interview, and she said that gay people were bad. Tom had to protect her, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, what is this? What are you doing to close the episode? You're just literally saying what just happened.
Oh, don't worry. It's the exact same the exact same scene with the exact same lines. We'll open the next episode.
Yeah. Right.
This first episode suffers from that. I'd say at least half of it is like one thing happens and then we get every single person like making phone calls and yelling at people in the studio like, here's what just happened. Okay. Oh, anyways, here's the next thing that's happening. Like it takes them so long to just catch up to the present when really the inciting incident was like probably 30 seconds long, actually, and shouldn't take this much work to explain.
I think it suffers from that sort of classic two-part episode problem of it's really 1.5 episodes, but you have to fill 2 episodes worth of time. And if this was like a Netflix original series now, this would be like a 62-minute episode.
We talk about that a lot on chats, like whether or not two-parters are necessary and which ones are and which ones are kind of bloated. And this one definitely feels bloated because, like you said, part one doesn't end. It just kind of like has a moment where someone recaps everything and then goes, weird, and then just closes really suddenly. And part two opens with exactly that moment again. But we talk all this mess, and we're going to talk a lot more mess because it's Studio 60, but like I didn't strongly dislike these episodes. I went into this really expecting to hate this. And I think part of what it is that guests bring a lot to this show. Like a lot.
John Goodman elevates these episodes so much.
So much. Especially part one. Part one would be unwatchable if it weren't for the John Goodman scenes. And then part two, because it starts without him, I was like, oh, I need this to get good again. And by the time we're in the diner, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
He really does. And yeah, just that, like, it feels weird that Aaron Sorkin is like finally doing what we've been asking for, which is critiquing his own characters for being shitty and elitist. Even though the person who is critiquing them also wants to know about the black guy's hair.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of like undersells him as a good character, but like, you know, people are complicated. People contain multitudes and all that.
Right.
So how do we get to Pahrump, Nevada? We can talk about that because the episode actually opens there. And the judge, John Goodman, is talking to Danny Tripp. We've got Tom, who is dressed like a shepherd and wearing a jacket. We've got Simon, who literally spends the entirety of this two-parter reiterating that he is, in fact, the one who possessed the marijuana and the jacket, and he does nothing else.
Yep. Yep.
We've got our man Jack Rudolph, the man of the hour, and we have our attorney for MBS, David Langenthal, as well as two folks coming to visit MBS from China. The girl's name is Kim, and her father as well are there as part of the Macau plot line, which I was positive was going to be done. Macau, yeah.
Yeah, I for sure thought that was like a one-off comment from Ed Asner's like big boss character. Oh, that's a weird thing that the super rich guy's doing. Anyway, back to TV land.
And then the previously on, they're just like, oh, blah, blah, blah. Oh, Harriet, blah, blah, blah. Macau. And you're Macau. Like, oh, okay.
Okay, I guess we're doing Macau again. Yeah, the previous one does a relatively good job of like setting up every weird unrelated plot line that's going to collapse into this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a kind of a delicate balancing act, putting all of those things into one space. But that's kind of the comedy of it, is like, why is this Chinese man and his daughter here? It's so dumb that they're here. They shouldn't even be here. But the show realizes that and still does it. And I feel mixed about that. There's a lot that I feel mixed about, right? Because mm-hmm. we also have this episode opening with everyone being like, ugh, this podunk Nevada, which is like not the South, by the way. It's just the West Coast, guys. It's fine. Just because it's slightly more rural than California doesn't mean that they're, you know, in Hicksville.
I mean,
well,
it's Utah. True. Or no, sorry, it's not Utah. It's Nevada. But Nevada. Yeah, it's literally
Western
not.
Nevada.
But I mean, there is a lot of that part of the country that is very Southern in culture. I don't like,
yeah.
I'm not here to real, say this is a fair real, characterization,
it,
but
yeah, I'm not necessarily fighting the culture wars here, but it gets real red, in the rural parts of the West, like
in the West, right?
The, I have driven through or been on a car driving through Northern California into Southern Oregon, the like kind of rural parts of it that call itself the state of Jefferson. And they want to like secede from California and Oregon.
Oh no!
There's a flag for it, and there's that over there. For sure.
And it's good. It's a good thing though that the show chooses to portray it like that. They're not trying to brush over that. But Sorkin again trying to take the moral high ground, and everybody is assuming that this John Goodman character is going to be super racist. And he's or like not know what culture is. And they're like, MBS, you don't know what MBS is? It's it's the national MBS. It's the National Broadcasting System. And you really should know it because it's like the most important thing. And he's like, oh, you got to shoot that guy for talking back at me. And that guy gets to get hog tied. And they believe him and they're all stressed. And he's like, why do you guys think I'm a hick? Why are you like this? Your cultural biases are showing everyone. But also your show sucks, which is the first moment where I fell in love with his character. He's like, your show is condescending and smartass, which I was like, oh, finally, someone on the show knows it's finally getting it. And that was very satisfying to me.
Yeah.
Even though, again, they kind of like they seem to not take a hard line with whether or not like John Goodman's character is like the stereotypical good rural type. Was like really smart and liberal, or if he's just like old, I don't know.
Yeah, they hit a weird balance. I feel like they would have like, he does say that like it's like smart ass and condescending. I really wish, and he's like making the point like, oh, I'm not stupid, it's just some people don't like it. But I really would have just liked it if he'd just been like, your show isn't funny.
Yeah, I know of your show, I don't watch it because nobody watches fucking your Friday night comedy show.
It's also his like awareness of NBS is still tied to other markers of like meritocracy. Like he's like, I'm not stupid, I'm a judge. You know, the fact that the one sort of red state rural voice that is dignified so far that we've seen in the show is also a judge feels like it, that's not actually that big.
Yeah, he's not an average. He's still not an average person.
Right.
And he also doesn't know how to – he can never remember what Simon's name is, which is another, like, yellow flag.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's made out to be racist in a pretty believable way. It's just also, like, so in your face. Like, look, see? He doesn't get that Simon's hair isn't dreadlocks. It's twists. And it's like, okay, yeah, that actually makes sense that that character would act that way. But the fact that it's – you know, there are things that are believable, but then everything in the script was like chosen and placed there, which, you know, makes you think about why did you make a whole thing?
Because I think portraying a racist is hard in modern TV to do it accurately. Like, it's either this cartoonish, like, what can I touch your hair? Why is it weird looking like that? What's your name again? I don't remember. I can't tell you guys apart. That's not the way it manifests itself in real life often. At least in conversation, like in groups like this, it's usually more of like ignorance or just not understanding and not this like very pressing, like, tell me why you're different kind of like racism, which is my other weird minor issue.
Well, I don't know. I think it was actually pretty believable because when he does the whole hair thing, he's more just like, he's like in his mind, I think he's trying to bridge the gap and ask like, how do you get your hair like that? You must have to use a special product. And I think it effectively communicates some of the like microaggressive aspects of racism. I just think that it's pretty ham-fisted in doing it.
That's more what it is then, right? Is that it's kind of ham-fisted, hammy?
Yeah, and there's some other – it's also hard because there's some other race stuff in these episodes that
– Oh, yeah.
Right.
Who hired the assassins? Fuck. That line broke me.
Yeah.
I believe that was Danny or one of the guys.
That was our boy Tom, actually.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Because obviously the most came to kill him.
While we're talking about the race stuff, I think the most egregious moment was when they're on the plane going to Nevada. I can't separate what's in the first half and the second half, so I figure we'll just talk about them holistically, right?
Yeah, we don't split the halves on this podcast anyways because we're, you know, in the future zone.
But they're in the plane going to Pahrump, Nevada, and Jack Rudolph – or Simon Stiles tells a joke about, like, corporate executives. And then Jack Rudolph is like, hey, Simon, I don't tell a joke about – I'm not going to repeat it. But he, like, lists, like, five different stereotypes about African-American people in a row. And it's like, wow, you really had those, like, right at the ready, huh? And he's like, come on, I don't do that to you, so don't do that to, you know, to my people.
It's
like, whoa.
And they portray it like this, like a limp response from Simon, but it really isn't when he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I guess I forgot how corporations have suffered centuries of, you know, oppression. Like, what? Fuck. Oh.
And Harriet mentioned something that kind of counters that in the second episode when she's talking to Matt and she's like, you can't compare gay people to black people. Some of them have experienced hundreds of years of subjugation. Some of them were able to be out for the last 30 years. Like, those things don't work like that. But yeah,
I guess the weirdness of it is just like that there are these moments that are like race conscious, but they're just moments. There's not a episode long sort of reckoning with it. And I don't know that this is going to get paid off later, but it seems like the show is aware that people are different races and aware that that means something and aware that it should be addressed, but is kind of doing it in this like perfunctory way that doesn't it doesn't really feel purposeful, I guess.
In that sense, oh, sorry, Six, go ahead.
I was going to say, and also, I feel like there's this issue where the show is using like some really like
some really like bad logic, like some logical fallacies in its race arguments that are mm-hmm. really like frustrating. Where like, I mean, when Harriet says like you can't compare like, you know, gay people to black people, it's like, well, on the one hand you can't, but on the other hand, I mean, like, you can't compare anyone to anyone. Everyone has different experiences. At some point you have to accept that when you're comparing someone, it's because they're not identical. Like, there has to be some point right. where you make a base of comparison.
Yeah.
It's this logical fallacy where she's like, well, they're not the exact same situation, so you can't talk about them, and it just seems stupid.
Yeah.
Right. And there are, and like Magellan, exactly like you said, there are very brief moments where I genuinely almost applaud the show for getting it. And one of them is when like we have Darius, who now gets a name and is now a real honest to goodness character on this show, mm-hmm. who is, you know, having a, is listening to Matt Albee, and Matt Albee's like, you know, I need you here as the only person who can tell me when my sketch idea is bad. And he like tells him this, he like sees the sketch and watches the rehearsal, and he's like, what do you think? And he goes, it was good. And he's like, no, seriously, like no one else is going to talk back to me. And he's like, it's all over the place. And he's like, no, get out of here. Don't do that. Yeah. Don't be mean to me.
Oh, what I got from it was like, I needed to hear that, and I'm frustrated, but I needed to hear that.
Yes, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think it's for once a good moment of Matt Albee being like, you know, it hurts, but no one else is going to do it, so thank you anyways. Mm-hmm. But like, ouchie.
I think it's also almost a good moment where Darius is talking to, I don't remember the Australian woman or the British woman's name.
I don't even know if they ever say her name. I looked for it.
I'm not sure. But when they're talking and he's asking about like, what are the rules for like who calls who sir? Because it seems sir. Totally arbitrary. And we had just gotten out of a scene where everyone was sarcastically calling each other sir.
Right.
Which was amusing to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that felt like an honest thing of like, you're a young writer in a space like this, you know, for the first time in your comedy career, and you're trying not to like piss anybody off or like step on anybody's toes. And mm-hmm. then him being like, you know, I guess it's a white people thing. I think I like that. Again, it did feel sort of like
written by a white person
and on the nose. The fact that he said it like that in that way. But then when her response was, oh, Darius, I'm not white, I'm British.
That's good. And then he goes, you should write that in a sketch.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah, I like him as, like, he almost feels like an audience surrogate, but it's this weird situation where Aaron Sorkin doesn't necessarily realize the way in which he's... Because it's like, he seems like a person who's in this situation and thinks it's wild. Mm-hmm. And I guess Sorkin is like, but don't worry, he'll adapt. And I'm sitting here like, I don't think he will. I think he's just going to keep his head and be like, this place is bizarre.
Yeah, I think this show, done in a better way, maybe he's the protagonist.
Mm.
Yeah, like the show starts with him getting hired on in that scene.
Yeah.
And then we're watching him be like...
I think something that Sorkin, when he did The Newsroom... that he did in kind of a, or he had like good intentions in doing this, was he made Maggie Jordan a main character, or it seemed that he was introducing her as a main character. And it's like, look, this is a young woman who's like trying to make it in the news world, and she's working her way up, and she's going to learn a lot of things. And it's a world that is sexist, and, you know, it's going to be hard for her to kind of become the next Will McAvoy, but let's see it happen. Or like Mad Men does that, right? With Peggy. And I think there's really a space here for Studio 60 to be doing something like that. But instead, it's just like, check out these two hotshot Hollywood handsomes. They're your main guys. Oh, yeah.
It's, I do very much feel up and down about all of this stuff. One of the B plot line, which we can talk about semi briefly because I think the Tom stuff occupies, you know, the large majority of this episode, is we have Matt Albee and Harriet Hayes are the two main cast members who are still grounded in California, and they are arguing back and forth about all sorts of stuff in this episode. Very like ideological battling about like sex policing and religion bashing and homophobia and all of this stuff that, like, you know, feels a little simple in 2020 to watch this stuff, but you understand that the show is coming out in 2006 and is being written by white guys. Like, this is like pretty smart conversation between the two of them. I like the line from Matt Albee, where in asking her why she didn't make a harder stance, he asks her, "Does your ass hurt from straddling the fence like that all the time?" Because he's basically saying, like, if you aren't anti-gay, why didn't you just say it? Because what she said was that the Bible, you know, forbids it, but the Bible also says, judge not your brother. So she basically, what she's saying is, I don't know. I can't decide. I can't supersede the Bible with my decision, which is honestly a very smart PR answer. As someone who is kind of the voice and the face of the Christian community in Hollywood, she has to answer like that, is how I felt about it.
Well, and, right. And it turns out actually to be a not smart PR answer for her, because now everybody at Studio 60 is pissed at her. And then Jordan McDear's like, hey, don't do those religious lady concerts. And then she's like, but I wanna. And then the religious lady concerts say, hey, don't do this because you didn't come out as like anti-gay, basically.
Yeah, you didn't take a hard line. So because she sat on the fence, she's sort of ostracized from both sides.
Right.
Which makes sense. I think, you know, the liberal in me wants her to, or the leftist in me wants her to just not even make this a question and be like, yeah, obviously no. But considering the time that they're in, considering her role in society, I understand why this is a struggle for her. The main conflict of that felt interesting to me, though, was like, it feels like nobody wants to listen to her explain herself, which is a common problem, like, you know, being a woman in Hollywood, being whatever. But she's trying to like work through this and she doesn't feel necessarily 110% confident about this statement. But everyone wants to pull a clip from it and decide that this is how she is. She's either anti-gay or pro-gay, and both of these are bad in some way. And she's like, no, I actually want to like massage out this idea with somebody in like an intellectual way, and not just have my face on a newspaper and be ostracized in all of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that stuff was super interesting. What about y'all?
Yeah, I think it shows you just how far the conversation has come in the past like 10, 20 years with regard to same-sex marriage and just like gender and sexuality in general, that this was like a conversation. I mean, here, you know, the line that I thought was really telling here was when Harriet was like, yeah, you know, I just said I wasn't sure. And like, there are Democrats who say that all the time. And it's like, yeah, that's yeah, true, especially at that time. And Matt Albee says something like, don't remind me that my party's full of like, you know, sycophants and mediocrities or whatever he says. So it definitely was a debate that was being had in the moment of, you know, how do we figure out how to kind of reconcile this with our cultural beliefs up to this point. And speaking of SNL, Alan, you and I think have made this observation that if you watch Weekend Update or things like that from the aughts, there are a lot of jokes where Tina Fey will like, or whoever in the sketches too, will like make gay jokes, but in a way where it's like, but it's cool to be gay, but it's also funny and weird. And that definitely was the conversation in 2006. And I think Matt Albee, for once, does a really good job of explaining why exactly that fence sitting is so dangerous, which is, he's saying like, look, when you talk about civil unions, you can't end that sentence with anything except an explanation of why homosexual love is less than heterosexual love. So like, let's not even go there.
He just felt so moralizing to me in that scene, though. He just felt like the Aaron Sorkin mouthpiece more than ever.
Certainly.
I mean, you know? It's that great Onion post, which is the worst person you know just made a terrible point or just made a great point. I don't like Aaron Sorkin, but yeah. I think I will allow him to get preachy about how you should treat queer people as though they have rights. I think I'll let him do that one.
Yeah.
And it's also like the thing that we always, I feel like we somewhat as podcasters and as critics forget to address with this show, is that he's not just talking about society. The characters are not just talking about their own beliefs. They're talking about what the network and what the people, like, standards and practices want. Like, they make a whole point about how the Jesus, as like the Jesus sketch that's like the center of this episode, is a big deal because S&P don't let them say, like, use sort of religious terms as a you know, sort of an exclamation or anything like that. Like, there's still, S&P is still working on that level in 06, even though a lot of the world has moved on beyond that. That, you know, they are in there to us kind of like slightly backwards world. There's an even more backwards, like, godly hand above them, making sure that everything that's said on television is squeaky clean and doesn't offend a single person.
Well, and not even that. It's, I would say it's, I mean, it is, I think, maybe a little more globally minded than it used to be, maybe even than when this show was going on, but it overwhelmingly is erring towards, like, Christians. Like, if you are offending, yeah, like, a Sikhist, I bet they don't care.
I bet they have other things to be worried about, like being allowed to live.
Well, I know, I think maybe the Sikh, I'm just saying standards and practices don't care. I'm saying, yeah, they're not out there being like, no, you can't say that about Buddha, because that's just, that's not where they're, like, they're right, not out there trying to keep people from being offended.
Their constituents are Christian, is what, right, I'm saying. They're, right, like, important. Yeah, I totally get that. And I think that's correct.
Yeah.
So I think that,
yeah, yeah, no, I think this is an episode where the Harriet and Matt debate felt, it felt like a legit debate that, like, a couple who disagreed about this might have. And Matt did feel pretty preachy and moralizing, but honestly, I don't know. Like, if I was with someone who was like, yeah, I just don't know if gay marriage is okay, I feel like I would also get up on that high horse a little bit. Especially if she started spouting about, you know, you cannot compare gay people to black people. And it's like, okay, well, there's more nuance than that. So for once, I think I was invested in Matt versus Harriet as both of them being, like, pretty well-meaning, well-intentioned people who, like, just happen to really strongly believe the things of their side of the culture wars, and also really love each other and, like, care that the other person be a good person. Yeah. And I really like the exchange between Matt and Harriet, where she's like, well, what is this whole culture wars thing anyway? And why do we fight? And then Matt goes, well, your side thinks we think you're stupid, and my side fights because we think you're stupid. I like that line. I mean, it's like a insufferable Sorkin line, but I liked it.
Yeah. Once you're in this show, you kind of have to accept that, like, that's the good that you're going to get. That's the quality.
Mm-hmm. And I do have one last gripe at this fictional character, which is, sure, it is, I mean, Matt brings it up, but it is like, also, you're not this person who's, like, separated from all of this. You're going in and saying, like, I just don't know if, like, gay people are okay, and then you're going to work with a bunch of gay people.
Right.
Like,
right.
What the hell, lady? So you're coworkers.
You can't just have that opinion and then work with us.
Right. Like, ostensibly, you're friends. Can you just, you know, stand up for them a little?
Yeah.
And, so she kind of, like, blows up at him about the whole, don't compare being black to being gay moment. And then the second episode wraps with, again, we just refuse to end a good episode on a good moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is they start flirting and they're getting closer and closer on the couch, and then she gets mad at him about how he never knows how to say I don't know. She says those are three words that would make a nice addition to your vocabulary. Again, a good thing that somebody should tell Aaron Sorkin or people like him.
I'm sure that's,
and then a minute later, yes, this is pulled from that. She says, God, Matthew, are you crazy about me or just crazy? And he says, I don't know. She goes, now he learns how to say it. And then I don't think they kiss, but they just kind of, like, have a tender moment, and then that cuts the episode.
I liked it. I really liked it. I'm sorry.
It was, you know, it was cute.
I liked
it. It's sappy, but I sometimes I'm in the mood for sappy.
You know what? Here's the thing. I am outside. I am above your petty concerns of large scare quotes love and relationships.
Scare quotes. Mm-hmm.
You people are sappy.
Yeah. That's a good Red Velvet song.
It's
sappy.
Honest. Y'all are like that.
I liked it. Because, like, they're fighting and stuff, and it's, like, this big fight. But then he's like, it should have been me. I should have been beating up those gay street toughs or whatever.
Such a weird part, though. That felt so artificial.
So weird. It's,
I thought it was really funny because you could see him start to say it and realize, like, ooh, yikes. I meant, like, I should be, like, helping, not like,
I bet that
gosh.
Was Matthew Perry really laughing at the fucking script.
Yeah.
I should have beaten up those gay street toughs. But it's so sweet, you know, that he's like, it should have been me making this stupid choice and getting in trouble for you because like at the end of the day
with John Goodman
at the end of the day, like, I love you more than I think you're stupid, I guess. And I thought that was sweet.
Put that on a precisely postcard.
Yeah.
That brings us to the other sort of meat and potatoes of this episode, which is everything that goes on with Tom over in Pahrump, Nevada, which is noted 60 miles west of Las Vegas. Real town, by the way. I'd love to visit someday. I wonder if they ever have people coming by that are like, oh my god, this is where that Studio 60 episode took place.
This is another... So every character like laughs at the name of the town.
Like every single character.
When Matt is telling them at the beginning of the second episode, he says, and get this, they're in Pahrump, Nevada, or whatever. And then... the guy who's always Nicolas Cage, whose character name I forget, he's like, it's funny. And Matt says, you want to say something? And he says, oh, that's just so hilarious. And then Jeannie's laughing at it too. And it's like, that's another example of Sorkin writing his plot and then being like, man, I wrote a good plot, huh? Found a pretty funny name for a town. Yeah, I looked at a map of Nevada, and wouldn't you know it? There's a funny name on there. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. We can toss in a bunch of jokes. We can really punch up this script with infinite jokes about, like, haha, funny.
He just zoomed into Google Maps until he found a silly town name in Nevada, and then he had all his characters laugh at it. And it's like, it's not that funny. It's not like Fucktown, Nevada or something. That's hilarious. That would be funny.
He's going for this sort of, like... absurd, almost like it's a play or something where like all of the serious stuff is happening but it's under the under the title of like Welcome to Pahrump, Nevada, like that's the sort of like high-minded comedy that I think he's going for.
Yes,
but having every single character comment on it sucks. It's just like not interesting.
And then also, by the way, it is sexual harassment when everything that Matt Albee does to Jeannie is sexual harassment. Like when...
What's your example, though?
I have two examples. When when Jeannie's laughing at Pahrump and he's like, haha, Jeannie, very funny. Whatever he says. It's like, yeah, I bet you'll be laughing when you're working at the Hooters off of La Cienega or whatever he says. And it's like, whoa, yeah. Okay.
Wow.
And then the whole plot line with DK, like being self-conscious about being at the desk, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
And then Matt Albee's way to get him all jazzed about it was to be like, hey, Jeannie, like flirt with DK really, really hard. And then she
does. Tells the other guy to basically gaslight him and like, look at him like he's doing terribly. Like what?
Yeah. And then he's like, Jeannie, flirt with him, please. And then Harriet's like, why can't I be the sexy flirt lady? It's always Jeannie. And Matt's like, she's got it going on or whatever. It's so gross. Ugh.
We haven't even started talking about Mr. Tao and his daughter Kim, though, which is its a whole box of turnips itself.
Yeah.
Yep.
But to basically get into the inciting event, which is unfolded very slowly over part one, and then the sort of kicker of like why it happened is in part two. We are on the Thursday before the show, and Harry's talking about the gay marriage stuff, and that's like the beginning of their conversation. And we're introduced to Mr. Tao and his daughter Kim, who were also in the sheriff's office. The whole joke is that she's his translator. Why does he need his daughter to translate? Why doesn't he just have a translator? Or why doesn't he just know English? I don't know. It's not my business.
I mean, but I don't know. Him not... Well,
okay, what is his role? Like, who is he? Does he own a company?
Yes. Yes, he owns...
Is it global? If it's a global company, I don't know.
I mean, like, it's a company that, like, I think the implication from previous episodes is that it's a company, like, you know, interested in Macau that is going global, but not has not historically been global.
There's still smaller scale. This is, to me, that explains why it's his daughter. He doesn't have a formal translator.
Well, and also, like, I mean, if you have okay, think about it like this, Alan.
Okay.
You are rich, right?
Hell yeah. Can't imagine it, but sure, go ahead.
You also have a daughter that you love a lot, but is going to school overseas. And you're I'm going to visit that country for business.
She goes to Juilliard.
I would love, why don't I spend some time with my daughter? I can, one, spend some time with her. Two, use the excuse for her because she's going to be like, Dad, why do I have to spend time with you? You're like, I need a translator. And also, how did you get rich? Not by spending money, by saving money. Save money, have your daughter translate for you.
That's a really, you are just the absolute lord of galaxy braining takes. And
you should see me come up with like theories about how games are going to end. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I love it.
I'm usually wrong.
Yeah, right? And so this is the whole Macau plotline. Basically, Jack Rudolph is tasked with making sure that this man is happy and his daughter is happy.
We're this close to Macau.
We're to Macau.
Take it to the last yard.
Goofy as hell. And we have this other goofy scene, by the way. There is a very brief moment of something like Jack Rudolph like talking about like, China is not that they're uncivilized, but like they don't have the technology that we do or something. It was a weird moment, but it's also one off line and I'm not going to like drill into it like I do so often on this show. But the part I did think was stupid was Danny and Matt inventing the whole Jesus is the head of standards and practices moment. That's supposed to be a satisfying scene where you watch the magic happen, right? They're talking about something else. They're talking about standards and practices, not letting them say like goddamn on TV. And they're like, he's like, now introducing the new head of standards and practices, Jesus. He's such a, I just wrote the best sketch. And he's like, get it on my desk by tomorrow. It's, you know, it's a gag, but I always want to like see more of that stuff. Like, how does the inception of a joke come from? Or is it really just, I had another conversation and I said a funny thing and now I want to do it. Because sometimes I do that. Like, not 2 nights ago, Six and I were on a call and I like, we kept like throwing out jokes and I was like, man, someone should write these down. These are like good jokes.
That sketch was also so dumb. Jesus sketch. Like the bits that we see.
Kind of funny.
I thought part of it was funny, but a lot of it was like, okay, this is...
Sure.
I can't remember. There was one joke that I almost laughed at. But by and large, it was like, this is so wordy. And he's like, well, you know, the water turns to wine and the whatever apostles, blah, 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 blah.
It's a lot of repeating jokes about someone going like, God damn. And he goes, yes. And they're like, no, not you.
Yeah, right. Also... I really doubt that a Christian person would be offended by that. Let me rephrase that. I really doubt that as a rule, any Christian person would be offended by that.
Huh.
And it seems as if Sorkin's presenting it as like, man, if you're Christian out there, whoo, this one's going to really grind your gears. Not really. You're depicting Jesus as a pretty agreeable guy. So I'm cool with it.
I almost wonder if you could ask your mom about that sketch. Because
I know my mom would laugh at that sketch.
You think so? Well, there you go.
For a fact. I think she'd be a little like, oh, why are they doing this? That's Jesus, you guys. But then she would think it was funny.
She wouldn't, you know, pull out her funding for the TV show, which is what they're ultimately so
No, because
about.
It depicts Jesus as a cool guy. That's nice. That's pleasant. Feels good. That's my dude up there.
And this is all them kind of like reading these lines in the restaurant. Then we go into like dress rehearsal and, you know, but before dress rehearsal, while we're in the restaurant, a bunch of them want to go outside and leave. And Harriet's leaving or something. And this is where we have the moment that leads to the arrest, right? We have a bunch of gay men who come up to Tom and Harriet and they ask for Harriet's autograph and she gives it to them and gives the very well scripted, like, this really made my day, guys. Thank you for being fans of my show and of my work. And they're like, wow, thank you. And they take one of her CDs and they throw it on the ground and smash it. And she's like, and it's fascinating. I love
this
scene.
And they're like, by the way, we're gay. We're going to beat the shit out of you because we're gay.
We're gay street tops.
You know, that's what gay people do.
Yeah, we're all gay street tops. That's accurate. And what's fascinating about the scene is she kind of is like ready for it a little bit, or she's like, Like, I'm sure she's had moments like this before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is not the first time this has happened, right? She's like, can we just talk about it? Can you please? And then they start to get kind of aggressive, and Tom runs outside, and Simon runs outside. And Simon's like, hey, back the fuck up. And they do the classic, like, what do you want? You want to start something? Want to start something? And Tom makes a bad decision. He shoves a guy. Honestly, looked pretty gentle, but I don't know if that's just the way this was filmed. But the guy kind of like pratfalls backwards over some bushes and then looks like he was severely, like, pretty decently hurt.
I think it was meant to come across as gentle because it was meant to be like, whoops, I pushed him just enough that it's a lawsuit.
Right on the and how easy it is for it to become a lawsuit. Like, it didn't even look like a serious fight. It was just like, hey, get the fuck out of here. No, you won't. Okay, push you a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's a lawsuit. Bam.
Did it kind of fuck you both up how nice the cops were to him when they came for
big
him?
Big time, bud. I wrote that in my notes. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable.
He's in dress rehearsal. They're getting ready to do the sketch. And then he's asked to go outside and these cops are like, hey, bud, how's it going? And he's like, good. They're like, listen, so some shit happened. It's fine. Whatever. Just these like guys. I mean, they're gay, right? And they like said that you push them and like they're going to press charges and they really just want some of your money. Can we have to process you, dude? Like, I'm sorry. And then he says something like, they say like, you can just put the bail on your credit card. It's fine. Like, I hate this so much. The American justice system is so...
Listen, you're rich. We know how it is. Poor people always trying to get that paper. Listen, I saw
some money at the problem. It'll be gone, right? Just, you're fine.
I found out that this was a specific slang that I can't actually use the other day, but I saw a friend refer to money as sheets. And I was, ooh. I loved it. Turns out it's outdated slang for the £1 note, so I can't really use it. But it's very good. Oh. It sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just looking for sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the fact that he's like, can I pay my bond with my credit card? And they're like, yeah, sure, you'll be out in an hour. We just have to like process you and do all the legal mumbo jumbo and you'll be fine. It's totally okay.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about the fact that your jacket also has, like, just so convenient that they're like, also just go right now. Like, dude, you're wearing Simon's jacket and you're going to take him to a police station. Like, just give him the jacket.
Yeah.
It takes, just give it to him. Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. So he's taken with the thing and in being processed, they also find out in checking his record that he was caught speeding in Nevada and he was never processed for that. And so we have to drive him over there. We have to extradite him to Nevada. To be tried in, and also more convenience, because we're just stacking convenience on top of convenience. It's a holiday and it's Friday. Just the legal nonsense that leads to this might actually put the episode airing at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Occupies a lot of this episode. So he's taken to Nevada. He's taken to Pahrump, Nevada, where he, you know, X number of, I think it was like years ago, they talk about like, yeah, he was speeding 120 miles an hour here. And at first, it just seems like I didn't even think that the reason for him speeding was going to be a plot point. But who I was
foolish
for that. I didn't
understand it fully.
So, okay, so he was speeding. He was going 120 miles an hour at some point in the past through Pahrump, Nevada, because he was in a rush to get somewhere. He doesn't want to talk about it. What they learn at the end of the episode was that he was driving his brother to the army base to be deployed. To go back to do his work where he builds hospitals.
No, see, it's even more complicated than that.
Is it really?
Yes. What it is that his brother was the one driving.
Oh, and he was his brother to get in trouble.
Right. So he was like, here, like, they pulled us over. I'll switch seats. I'll take the hit.
Wow. Dumb. No, not honestly, not that dumb. Like, totally get it. And like, you know. I respect that part. It's the part where this gets him off that really just is the show turns into a farce.
The fact that John Goodman's character does like some Sherlock Holmes stuff to figure it out, and then he's like, "Boy, I'm a regular Sherlock Holmes," or whatever
he says. "I'm Agatha Christie."
Yeah.
Like, John,
I'm Agatha Christie, except for I respect the troops.
I love the troops. I love the Mets, and I love women.
And I love pie.
And then just, again, convenience. Like, Tom doesn't realize he has the weed in his jacket that was Simon's. And Simon wants to have it known on the record that it was his. And
Simon acts
when he's
like such a moron in this episode that is really frustrating.
It's like they didn't have anything to, for him to do, so they just threw this line at him and didn't write him anything else. But, like, you need to remind them at every possible moment that it is you, and all you want in life right now is to be the person who's
in jail.
You know, gets the
you just want to make sure that as many people are as indicted in this as possible, and you need to ignore anyone explaining how the law works and just say this over and over.
And the reason that Tom gets caught is he's playing with a dog. It's so weird how suddenly he's like, I'm a dog person. Whoa, cute dog. Wow. Is he real? Is it such a cute friend? Wow.
Is he real?
Sorry. Is he like, what a cool dog? And then the dog starts barking and they're like, yeah, the dog is trained to smell drugs. You're in trouble, big boy.
See, I actually, that is one part that I actually liked, because I extremely buy, especially this, like, this Hollywood actor who, like, is, like, completely out of his depth, like, hauled off to a different state and is being arrested in this other state, and he's just, like, super nervously trying to break the ice. That seemed extremely in character to me.
That's his anxiety manifesting. He's like, dog.
Exactly.
Sure. And so it's him and it's all the other people, and Jack Rudolph is stressing about this and also stressing about Kim and her dad, and she's just a poor girl who is in the meeting. And I like this moment where he is, before he gets to Nevada, he's having the whole situation explained by Jordan. It's kind of fun watching the information trace, like, across this episode, going from, like, Danny and Simon talking in a private room to Jordan being outside to hearing it, and then she tells Rudolph, and then Rudolph goes to Nevada with them. And as he's hearing it, he's going, and she's like, don't act surprised. Don't act like you're freaking out. And he's like, okay. And she's like, your number one actor is being extradited for a crime that he doesn't remember, like, he in a different state. And he's like, Anyways. And then Kim decides that she wants to go because she gets to meet Tom, and she's obsessed with him and pop culture and kissing boys.
I really want to shout out the guy who's playing Jack Rudolph. I've really come around on this guy.
He's so fun in these.
I liked him in the previous episode. In the previous episode, from a previous podcast, I forgot to call out the scene where he's, like, running around yelling, like, somebody fight me. Really loved that. Right. and then him here, you know, doing the super artificial, like, what's the name of the town?
And you hear her, like, very crisply go, like, Pahrump, Nevada.
Just like,
and he's like, cool.
I love that he's just awesome. He's constantly coiled with rage, and he keeps trying to find places where he's justified in releasing all of his rage, and he keeps getting stopped. Like, when they come into the courthouse for the first time, or the police station or whatever it was, and he's like, here, I got this black American Express card, like, get the guy out of there. It's right.
You put $1 million on it. Like, cool that you have money, rich man.
Oh, because the Nevada guy was like, oh, a bunch of Hollywood guys going to throw their weight around here. And yes. Tom's like, no. And then that happens, which I thought was pretty funny. And then Jack Rudolph is, like, yelling at the lawyer guy. I love one of my favorite bits someone was like, where'd you get this guy? And he was like, he's a copyright lawyer. He's not even a... whatever.
And the guy's like, that's news to me.
And then there's the bit where he's yelling at the judge and he gets, like, almost arrested for contempt. And then at the very end where, oh my God. And I just remembered when he steals Kim's camera.
And just breaks it.
He's like, oh, cool.
Well, can I see that? Wait, can I see that? Hold on, really? Cool.
Oh, dropped your camera. Oh, no. Oh, bummer. Dropped it. Oh, he picks it back up, twists it.
Like, shatters it in his hand. Like, can I be, like, super real right now?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was me for the first 25 years of my life, was just a super angry person looking for a place I felt justified spending that anger.
Yeah. It's really relatable. It's really,
just like,
really,
I have all of this power, but I'm just being, like, I have my hands tied behind my back, sometimes literally, and I'm also trying to appease this person who has, like, my job, my balls in his hand, metaphorically. He's completely, like, fucked from every direction, basically.
And then he, like, tries to stop Kim from reading her magazine, and she's like, what are you gonna do? Or you broke my camera. And then he's like, what? You can't break a magazine. Clearly, he had been thinking he would just rip it in half or something. And then the cherry on top of the whole Jack Rudolph story is when they're back at the studio, and then Kim pulls up the rumor about Jordan on her BlackBerry, reads it to her dad, and then there's a misunderstanding where she says that her dad said, "Oh, this woman has brought dishonor upon your network," and then Jack Rudolph gives this whole huge speech about like these people, they're so honorable. Like, fuck you, go make the deal with Time Warner.
He has a Sorkin moment.
Yeah, he has this great Sorkin moment of like, yeah, I am God or whatever. And then she's like, oh, it was a misunderstanding. He said her ex-husband was dishonorable. And then Jack Rudolph has to be like, oh, well, would have been nice to tell me that. Cool.
Anyways, I've lost my job.
Yeah, and Danny Tripp is like, oh man, Jack, I love you so much, I could kiss you. All right, goodbye.
Yeah, I love that scene. I think so we can dig more into that later.
Mm-hmm. And Danny and Jack playing off each other is a fun yes. pairing.
Yeah, Danny has that sort of like chill, cool atmosphere to like counter Jack's.
Yeah, like when Jordan tells him that he needs to put up a fight for the Jesus sketch and then give up on it. And then when Jack's like, you're not doing that Jesus sketch, Danny's just like, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. He's like, all right, okay.
Okay.
Not doing it.
Right. I was supposed to put up a fight.
Yeah. He doesn't even forget. He's just like, oh, by the way, just like if anyone asked, I put up a fight, right? Because Jordan says you need a win. And he's like, oh, girl,
I'm even more mad.
Yeah, he truly is. Steven Weber is the actor's name. He's really great in this episode.
I love him. He was my favorite of both of them.
Yeah, and John Goodman's character, the judge, basically gets to ham it up for the rest of part two. And since everybody's on vacation, they have to have the presiding prosecutor come back from his what the fuck is it? Paintball trip, which literally only exists so that we have a gag where he almost shoots the guys with a paintball dart or bullet or whatever.
Oh my god, my favorite
gag. It's a ball. It's a paintball.
Paintball, sorry. I forgot. I don't know. I've never done anything in my life.
My favorite gag was when Danny calls Matt and Cal and tells them that the guy's coming back from his paintballing trip. And then they hang up the phone.
Yeah, Cal, he goes, you ever go paintballing before?
And Matt's like, no. You? And Cal's like, no. And Matt's like, you want to keep talking about it? And Cal says, no.
No. Very funny.
That was funny. You got me, Sorkin. That was really good.
You did it. You wrote an actual funny moment. Yeah, and so because of this stuff, John Goodman's character is like, well, we're going to ride this out. So you guys are here for as long as I want you to be here, you big foofy Hollywood types. You hungry? We're going to go to the best diner in all of Nevada. It's across the street. You're going to love it. Let's have some fun. And they do have some fun. They get a meal, which later one of the characters says, you need to go there. It's some of the best food I've ever had in my life. I love that. And even though they're in a diner, like theoretically not on the clock, he's still asking them about culpability and trying to understand if it's probable cause and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And being like, even though it's not your weed and you say that, it's still been smoked. So like, is it use or is it possession? Like, what is the truth of the situation? I really like that. Him playing, like he says, Agatha Christie and like unraveling the story and exactly who needs to be charged with what. Mm-hmm. What eventually catches everything though is when they're back in the police office with the guy. The guy notices that Tom has a military band on his wrist, and it's got his brother's name on it. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're like, "What's up with that?" And he's like, "Yeah, you guys figured it out." And then just from there, it's a skip, leap, and a hop to them being like, "Oh, I figured out the entire storyline. You were driving your brother. He's really important. What does he do? Wow, he builds hospitals in 3 days. That's amazing. He's doing the God's work. I love the troops so much." Yeah, fine. Forget it. You're free for everything. None of this is real anyways. And he's let off. And they're sent home. It's like, it kind of feels like a Deus Ex Machina or like a military Ex Machina. Just as soon as you play the troops card, everyone is suddenly like, oh, sorry, sorry. No, no, you're good. You're respectful. I believe everything you say. And I don't care about your crimes anymore. Because the assault thing is not on their jurisdiction, right?
Well, and he'll still have to deal with that. But, the Hollywood cops already made it clear. They're like, that shit's not going to stick.
Yeah, no, you're an actor. Come on.
They don't arrest actors.
Right.
And so, yeah, they get back and the episode happens. Everyone's saying thank you and all this stuff. There is that like brief C plot that Magellan referenced earlier about the other writer that's with Darius, the British woman, who is makes this sketch that I actually thought was kind of charming, like not a bad idea for a sketch, mm-hmm. where it's like a bunch of doctors playing operation on a woman and they're like, all right, let's take out her self-esteem, let's take out her confidence. And then he just has to Sorkin it. And he goes, wait, did you have a breakup? And she's like, oh, I was the one. Because that's how women be.
Yeah, I was like, why is this in this episode?
Literally, I don't know. I don't even know. It's just like it's time filler scenes.
It seems like it was only to illustrate that Danny is a better producer than Matt. Because Danny comes in and he's like, hey, you're fine. Get up. You'll be good. And then she's like, okay.
Which is weird. She like, was like,
Matt, you see how I did that?
Like, well, no, because what he tells her, it's like, put it in the show. And then Matt has to be like, don't tell her to put it in the show. Like, let her work through her own trauma. She doesn't have to write it or whatever.
Yeah.
He tells her, like, put it in the script or something.
Yeah, you put it in your, like, put it into your writing. It's just like, no, listen, don't have real feelings.
No, just fake feelings.
She also did. She did put it in her writing. That's what got us here.
Right, she literally did.
Yeah. I love Danny's whole attitude in this episode is really funny because he didn't have to go. He literally almost doesn't go. And then he's like, no, this is what producing is. No, it's not. Send someone else, like an assistant producer or something. You're the head dude. Interns are for.
Yeah. It's not a quick, I mean, it seems it's a pretty quick flight from California to Nevada, I think. Probably like an hour.
Yeah. But also he had no role in it whatsoever.
Yeah. He's just there to react to stuff pretty much.
Yeah.
I think it's an accountability thing. It's nice to have somebody important up there in case anyone says anything or does anything bad.
I guess so. Yeah.
And I also feel like it's like just a character thing where like, you know, the kind of person who's going to become a producer is the kind of person who is not going to be able to sit on the sidelines while this happens.
True.
Yeah.
True.
And then the other like last minute scene was the one that Magellan referenced earlier, the whole Jack Rudolph misunderstanding translation stuff, which is silly but funny and gives Jack Rudolph an opportunity to be very like righteous, and I like that moment of like it's actually very honorable that Jordan wants to like have a life and not have her have her career ruined by a shitty ex who wants to sell a book, actually. And fuck you, you should go to Time Warner if you want to sell your dumb crap that I don't need. And it's just it's like, oh, sorry, I don't know how Chinese works. it's a subtle translation difference.
I think the only two things that we haven't talked about are Jordan.
The weekend update stuff.
And the weekend update stuff with DK. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, okay.
What is there to say about Jordan?
Just that it's still stupid that her whole character is centered around like rumors being spread by an ex.
Mm-hmm.
It feels dumb. And then this rumor especially is like so innocuous that she's like, I'll never get pregnant, I'll never have kids, I'll never hire a woman with kids. Like that, I think that would show up in the news, but it would go away so fast.
She'd be gone so fast.
I mean, like it would be really easy. She'd be like, here is a list of people I've hired who have kids. This is obviously not true.
Yeah, I said that when I was 24 or whatever. I'm a different person now.
Also, probably didn't even say it when she was 24. Probably just made up.
Misquoted or something, yeah.
So since it wasn't on the list, I will very quickly hit up. It's interesting, on the episode where we're talking about China a lot, we get to see a quick sketch, which is like Chinese tech support with an accent.
Oh my god.
Wow.
I'm surprised you two were just going to breeze past that one.
Oh, God, I blocked it from my fucking memory.
I have so many notes. I couldn't possibly get to it. That was profoundly bad. Yeah. Yeah. We have just a whole... It's like a tech support thing, right? Where it's like, MasterCard customer support. And the woman on the phone has like a thick... What kind of... Is it an Asian accent, I guess?
It's supposed to be... It's clearly supposed to be Chinese with the way she's doing like her L's and R's. It is so racist. It is really intense.
Super bad. Yes. I can't put a clip of that. I can't reference that. It's, I can't. I'm not going to do an impersonation of it.
It's like full on yellow panic. It's so bad.
Yeah. And the whole gag is like, it's not even a misunderstanding joke. It's that she's just doing what credit card. Because the thing is, that's the weird thing about the accent, right? Is they got an Asian woman to do the voice, at least in the rehearsal, right? Mm-hmm. And the joke isn't that he doesn't understand her accent. The joke is that she's asking too many questions about like what his purchase history was.
And like it's,
yeah, and she's like talking down to him about what he's bought. Or something.
And like, it's not it's not a funny sketch. I'm not trying to say that, but like, the idea is a plausible idea for a sketch without the racism element.
No, just without the accent.
Just the like, we're just making sure that you. It says here you spent $60 on a sock. Oh, you did. Oh,
why?
Yeah. No, I mean,
that's like a fine, serviceable sketch that someone's buying too many boutique, sort of fancy versions of things.
Yeah, the modern version of that is like, why did you spend $800 on Blue Apron in the month of December or something?
Yeah.
No, because I would spend $1,000 on Blue Apron if they'd let me. They cut me off. They said you had enough.
Oh my god, but
your apron has dyed blue.
But the accent does nothing. Yeah, it adds nothing. It does nothing. It's just...
There isn't really a way that it could add anything, but no. I think... This would be more bald-facedly racist if it was the joke was like, excuse me, huh? I don't understand, but it's
yeah, like
that.
If he tried to say the words he thought she was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stupid.
It just makes it more confusing. Why is it even there?
Yeah.
No idea. Just because I mean, Aaron Sorkin's a pretty racist dude, to be honest.
Sure.
Magellan, you seemed interested in talking about the Weekend Update guy, Dylan.
I think I'm just interested to the extent that I don't think it... I don't know. Like, there's just so much time devoted to it, you know?
So what Magellan's talking about is the fact that the character of Dylan DK, one of the main cast members, is being asked to replace Simon if he doesn't make it back from Nevada in time on their Weekend Update so that him and Harriet do the news, because you have to have two people ping-ponging, which is correct and true about Weekend Update. Mm-hmm. The dynamic is that it's two people, and he's nervous about it because, you know, he doesn't have the cadence. He doesn't know what his motivation is. These are very realistic things to be worried about, honestly. Yeah.
And also he feels more comfortable in his, like, he's like, well, historically the roles I do are like voices and caricatures. And like, I again, it's so, they do a bad job of it, but I do buy this idea of this guy who's like, the kind of comedy I've done for so long is like, hiding behind layers of identity and just being out there and being myself scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, I think totally that's what I liked about it is for all the fun that you can have with Jack Rudolph breaking a camera in his bare hands in the middle of Nevada, which is really very fun. So much of that is not about sketch comedy at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is something to be said for the fact that like, there are human stories you can tell about working on a sketch show that this show just isn't really telling. Like what we were talking before about if Darius was the point of view character of the show, what would it be like to write a show about someone who's like one of the only, if not the only, black person in a sketch comedy writer's room? I would watch that show. And then, yeah, like what Six was saying... That again, this is a very human plot of, you know, I'm like the goofy guy. I'm kind of a bigger guy. People have always laughed at me, and I was able to turn that into something and turn that into something I could control with like boisterous characters. But yeah. I don't know how to play me.
Myself. The whole thing with Weekend Update is that you ostensibly play yourself, right?
Yeah.
Like, what if you put on a suit and Ken jacket, like a suit jacket? And read news stories off a cue card and did like a fun, like an affect with that.
Yeah. And like, yeah, I don't know. But it just isn't like, they don't land the plane on it really. It's just kind of like an idea that is half baked and I liked and had some moments I liked, but because there's so much else going on.
It ends with Simon talking to Dylan through the mirror and being like, you can totally do it. Like, if you want to do it with me as a third chair, I'd be fine with that. And he says, no, it's your chair, Simon. And he's like, thanks, man. And that's it. Like, that just seems like such a nothing conclusion to what is, again, a very believable, like, good example of something that sketch comics must have to deal with all the time. I mean, hell, I, as a fat person, like in high school especially, would often do the classic like use humor to deflect the fact that I don't want to just be myself around some people. Like I feel uncomfortable with that, or I don't feel good at that. Or like in my improv class, I remember a guy that was in a couple of our classes who only knew how to do voices and bits, and every time he was expected to just play himself or play it like kind of straight, he couldn't do it. He got really awkward and nervous because he was like, I don't know how to just be normal. Like, I don't know how to be myself. That's hard. It is. So all of that stuff is very like believable and good, and then it's just a C plot in what is otherwise a very busy, goofy episode.
And it's anchored in, no, it's okay, I would rather go be Mexican Santa.
Right. Him looking at the mirror and being like, huh, here I go.
back into my comfort spot, brown face. And you're like, oh.
I forgot that he had the mustache too. Yes. there's comedy to that. I don't know how intentional it is, but there's a comedy to being like, all right, time to be my true self, Mexico. Hola.
It's bad.
Like, that is the joke, but the way I'm delivering is way better because the show takes it so seriously.
Yeah. You're right. It could be a good joke.
Right. It's the skeleton of a very good joke. Yeah, so I mean, this is a dense pair of episodes, but does anyone else have any like stray notes or thoughts?
I just loved it. The moment where DK's nervous and then Harriet's like, hey, look at me. And then she does an incredible funny face.
So good.
It's really good. She like turned into a human cartoon character.
Instantly. Yeah.
It was awesome.
That laugh, I wonder if that laugh from him was real.
I'm sure it was.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a very good moment. Because sometimes that's all you need is a funny face.
Yeah.
Six, do you have anything?
No, I mean, I between John Goodman and just sort of, I guess, the overall momentum, I don't think these were great episodes, but I had an okay time this week. And that's reassuring. It's been sort of a downward slope, and it's nice to be like, maybe it'll be okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, there are just things in this episode that are like good tropes, you know? Like Matt and Harriet is kind of exhausting, but some of the beats of their relationship are just good relationship tropes that like rom-coms trade on all the time. That's why it works. And they're fun, clever humor moments. I actually thought the second episode was like a good episode of television.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is I'm really picky with my rom-coms. I either fall madly in love with them, or I can't stand them.
I'm not picky. I love them all.
You love them all. That's fair. But that's pretty much what we got, folks. I want to hear what people think. If we ever are able to like slot in some emails for these, I'm really curious, like what the rest of the listening base thinks about Studio 60, because it's on an upswing now. I'm officially okay saying that.
Last week was so bad.
Anything better than that is up, right? It can only go up from there.
It's not a swing. It's just an upswing.
And I'm curious, Magellan, if you don't mind, if you could tell me what we can look forward to next week on Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats.
Next time on Studio 60, we're watching episodes 9 and 10. First, we're watching episode 9, The Option Period. After the show wraps, Matt discovers that Ricky, recurring guest star Evan Handler, and Ron, recurring guest star Carlos Jacot, are planning to leave and take the writing staff with them. Meanwhile, Harriet contemplates doing a lingerie spread in a magazine, and Jordan and Danny wrestle with budget cuts.
Sounds like business as usual. Harriet makes a bad decision, Jordan and Danny flirt, and side characters take the stage. Sure.
Yep. Then we have episode 10, B12. While the cast members work through the show despite being ravaged by a virus, Matt must survive the week with a new and much smaller writing staff. Meanwhile, Jordan tells Danny that she is
pregnant.
Pregnant.
Hell yeah. Wait, Jordan tells Danny? Danny tells Jordan.
Jordan tells Danny.
Yeah, no, Danny tells Jordan that she's pregnant. She's like, hey, Jordan, I don't know if you knew.
Hey, I think you're pregnant.
Right, that's exactly what I was imagining. I was like, huh? And then at first I was like, wait, B12, why do I recognize that? It's obviously it's the vitamin, I'm assuming.
I think
because
so,
I was
yeah.
like, wait, is that the... I thought it was the planet from The Little Prince, but that's B612.
Le Petit Prince, you mean?
Yes, sir. By Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, maybe? I love the French language. It's beautiful. And I love my two friends and my co-hosts on this podcast. Let's take it to the plug zone so we can all talk about our things that we do.
Are we chatting first or before?
Like, we chat some last.
I'm sorry.
Last.
I'm sorry. Cut that out. It's gone. Okay, it's all off the air. It's all gone.
Yeah, we're off the air.
Oh, we've great. Cool. Perfect. I'm just gonna plug to the empty air then. So I am on Twitter at @6detmar. SixDetmar. On there you can find a pinned tweet on my profile, which is all the shows and everything that I do. You should go to scanlandmedia.com or patreon.com/scanlandmedia, and I will specifically shout out, as Alan mentioned, we just put out a new episode of Bottle Crow Jackie's Chow, which was originally a Dota podcast, but these days is mostly us talking about cooking and doing, like, weird improv comedy. It's a good time. I think you would have fun with it.
I'm excited about it. And as for chats, we have an email address, as always, that is chatspod@gmail.com. And we also have a Twitter @chatspod, chatzpod. You already know the vibes. And it's patreon.com/chatspod if you want to give us money, support us, get bonus content, help us continue to do this show and feel like we're valid. And you can do that also if you don't have the financial means by simply rating us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. Folks, we do Chatsums here at the Chat Salon Studios, which is conveniently located right next to Studio 60. And I want to know, Six, what is your Chatsum for this week?
So, folks, as this is coming out, I don't know what's going on because I don't know when this is coming out. But as we're recording this, I'm in quarantine, like a lot of us. And I had a moment last night where I was like, hang on a minute. This place is a mess, and it wasn't, like, super dirty, right? Like, okay. I haven't been keeping the place dirty, but I did realize, like, I organized a lot of these spaces to be spaces that I'm not spending a lot of time in, right?
Right.
And I was like, since I'm spending all my time here, I should rethink the way I'm using this space. So I am, my chatsum, what I'm suggesting y'all do is you take a look at your living spaces as you are trapped in them, and say, maybe this could work better for the way I'm living now. I rearranged my bedroom, like, I moved my desk to the middle of the room. Previously, I had to go around my bed to get to my desk every time,
boy.
Going in and out of the room. Stupid. Why did I do that? Now the bed's out of the way, and I have this open space where I can exercise, and, you know, just, like, take a look at your life and see if you could shuffle a few things around and make it better.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
I like that. Majan, what about you? What do you got for chatsums?
My chatsum is, so we're recording this in late April, and very recently Netflix put out a 3-episode series of long form improv comedy. The episodes are about 50 or so minutes long. It's starring Thomas Middleditch and Ben Schwartz. It's called Middleditch and Schwartz. And yeah, they just kind of talk with an audience member and then do like a 50-minute improvised comedic play. And it's really, really filling the need, or scratching the itch, or whatever you want to call it, for seeing an improv show, because that's not something that I'm like able to do right now. It's awesome. It's really funny. It's short. It's sweet. I highly recommend it. Middleditch and,
like,
and Schwartz.
I like them both a lot. Yeah, Middleditch and Schwartz. That's for people who...
Yeah, they're, like, I've loved Ben Schwartz for a while. Thomas Middleditch is pretty cool, too. I've seen Thomas Middleditch before in improvised
Shakespeare.
In person,
right? In what? True. In person?
Yeah, in an improvised Shakespeare show. So
very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I like him in Silicon Valley. He's surprisingly good in an otherwise, like, decent show. Yeah, And I mean, I'm actually really curious to check that out. I was just looking, like, I mean, Instagram is doing amazing right now because everybody is doing live streams from their phone just because they're bored and sad, which is a mood. And I saw there's like a channel or whatever, there's a page on there that does every weeknight they have like comics, stand-up people doing stand-up from their homes. And I don't want to get that too into it because they're all like, you know, that's like a varying quality. But the idea of that seems really cool, that like we are finding ways to bring stand up and improv and whatever to people in a new format. But goodness gracious, folks, in terms of my chat, I just want to give a big old honking shout out to the YouTube channel Number File, which Magellan introduced me to.
Yes.
It's a very cool math based sort of comedy and educational YouTube channel. They have a lot of videos on there. The more popular one that people might recognize is, it's called The Scientific Way to Cut a Cake. And it's basically explaining how, like, when you cut a cake the traditional, like, you know, cut down the half and then make it into triangles way, if you don't finish it, then the half that's open is going to dry out when you leave it in the fridge. But if you cut it the scientific way, then you never have a dry piece of cake. And it's kind of wild. And just in general, like I think math, even like basic algebra and calculus, we kind of forget and like put behind us as we get into the working world and out of like college or whatever, if that's not your field of study. And it's cool to remember, because I think like I studied a lot of science and stuff in college, and we only did math up to a point, you know, like you do enough to learn to say that you did calc and you did calc 2, and then you're done. You never do math the rest of your life. But as I've been relearning a bunch of math stuff, channels like Number File kind of remind you that like this stuff is really, it's like basically magic.
Yeah.
And I know that's like kind of sappy to say, and I think some people would even take umbrage with the idea that like pure statistics and numbers are magical, but it's just so fascinating, and there are so many concepts in the like basic stuff that you learned in high school that are really complex and fascinating and beautiful. So it's a plug for both Number File and just the idea of getting back into math as an adult. And that, dear folks, is going to do it for this episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. Thank you to Magellan and Six for being the two rocks to my two hard places. And thank you for listening. We're starting the clock.
Stopped.
Oh, yeah, we stopped. Start. The clock is stopped.
Start it up. Start me up.
Start me up. Stop Peter Frampton. When are we going to get Peter Frampton on the podcast?
Didn't we do a whole thing about Peter Frampton years ago? We
super did 4 years ago. Wow, I forgot. All right, no more. No bits are real.
Okay. Could you insert that Escape Chats episode just at the back?
The whole episode?
Here. Yeah, where I kept editing in Baby, I Love Your Way.
Yeah, for sure. Here you go. Woo! Goodbye, everyone.
Woo, baby, I love your way.
There we go, folks. That's the episode. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. Magellan, of course, is referencing Escape Chats episode 43 back in October of 2016, when we dedicated an episode to Peter Frampton, who is still not dead, by the way, at least of the recording of this epilogue segment. Anyways, hi, did you enjoy us talking about Nevada Day? I feel like we didn't talk enough about how good John Goodman is in this episode, but you do get to hear the beginning of us falling in love with Jack Rudolph, who goes on to become again and again one of our favorite side characters in this TV series. I keep having this weird nostalgia for the time that we were recording Sunset Chats when I listened to this, because late April I was like in a different office, and quarantine seemed like it was going to be so short, and I don't even know. It was just a different, it feels like it's a time traveling podcast in a way. But if you would like to travel with us in our podcast spaceship, you should check out our Patreon, which is patreon.com/chatspod. I already plugged it in the episode, but over on the Patreon, the last couple episodes we have, Magellan put out a new episode of the Chats Files, where he is watching the X-Files, and he got a lot out of the first episode of season 2 of that show, Little Green Men, so he's enjoying that a lot. We actually did a spur-of-the-moment pilot chats back on February 2nd for The OC, which is a show that we're very interested in potentially covering. So we did that because we were bored and we said, let's watch The OC. It's been recommended to us. Sure, why not? We also have our February content poll, which seems to have settled on a couple of good things. And in the meantime, Magellan actually filmed a tutorial of how to do a recast via the Simplecast website, where the people get the podcast. And yeah, you should, if you're interested in pulling clips from chats just because you think they're fun and you want to help get the show's name out there, those do really well on relatively well on social media, and I think people should check them out. So yeah, that's what I got. Oh yes, here the February content poll was for movies. I have to read my own content poll real quick, you guys. The February content poll was The Princess Bride, and then we're gonna do some other stuff too. It's gonna be great. That's patreon.com/chatspod. I hope you're all well here in 2021. I don't know what's really going on in February. I could start a segment where I read the news to really date each of these episodes, but instead I'm just gonna say, baby, we love your way, and thank you for listening to Chats.